Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Preacher Boys podcast. Today's guest is Christian ethicist David Gushee. He's the author of many articles and a ton of books, including most recently, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. It is a absolutely riveting book that is packed with so much information that you could hardly retain it all on one reading. It's an absolutely fascinating book. And I brought David Gushee in to kind of continue some dialogue I've been having regarding kind of the cultiness of the election cycles, the dangers of authoritarianism rising up in face of democracy, and so much more. This is a really fascinating episode that I truly enjoyed. We even ended up getting into the conversation surrounding Taylor Swift and potential conspiracies there. It's a really good conversation. Again, for those of you who are adverse to political dialogue, this may be one to just go ahead and skip or just go into knowing that some of it may not be appealing. I don't expose all of my political beliefs on this episode, and I'm not specifically trying to get someone to consider one particular party over another. My goal is really that the conversation will really steer us back to discussions of shared values as citizens of whatever country you're in, whether it's the United States or elsewhere, and what it means in community to have dialogue that actually moves conversation regarding politics forward instead of turning into a us versus them mentality constantly. So I really hope you appreciate this episode. If you haven't read it already, be sure to pick up a copy of Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies, written by David Gushee. But before you read the book, go ahead and listen to this episode with David right here on the Preacher Boys podcast. David Gushee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eric. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you on, and really excited to talk about this topic, but also a little panicked entering conversations about politics because it's outside the realm of what I normally cover on the show. But as you can imagine, it's been something that's just happened to pop up in conversation after conversation. And it was really fascinating. I was listening to a lot of your content, reading through your book, and I came across an interview in 2016 where you said that white evangelicalism is all the time at risk of becoming a voice of white reaction and a voice of regressive and retrogressive politics that is sub-Jesus and sub-Christian. And I have to ask, sitting across from you in 2024, how does it feel to be a prophet?
I had forgotten that I said that, but it is where we have arrived. I mean, it is accurate. And the unequivocal evangelical embrace, or nearly unequivocal evangelical embrace of Trump all these years later, after everything, I guess that does make that statement look pretty, pretty prescient, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly does. And I know and we can dive a little bit deeper into this a little later, but I know that the Trump campaign was a starter pistol for many on the, what's now become a buzzword, this deconstruction journey, or this conversation of what does faith mean in modern day evangelical context. And I think that's probably a good starting point, because you're coming at this from the perspective of a Christian ethicist. And for many, I mentioned before we hit record, the term Christian ethics can feel like an oxymoron when we're looking at evangelicalism in its current state. So tell me really quickly how you're approaching this from a Christian perspective, and what the current political climate looks like and means to you today.
Christian ethics attempts to help Christian people think about their moral responsibilities and what faithful following of Jesus would look like. And so one aspect of following Jesus is public life. It's how we engage politics and culture. And I would say that political ethics, if you want to call it that, is an area where Christians have messed up repeatedly. In different cultures and different eras. It's hard to get this right for some specific reasons, but the fact that Donald Trump as a political phenomenon would be impossible without the ironclad support of a massive number of white evangelicals signals to me a remarkable failure in Christian discipleship. Just a remarkable failure in Christian ethics. He should have been ruled out for 100 different reasons within the first month of running for president in 2015. And the fact that he's still on the stage and indicates some really unfortunate things about where Christians in this culture are.
Yeah. There was a clip of Bill Maher very early on, and he was sitting across from Ann Coulter, one of the great minds of our day, and asking who she thought was going to win the election.
And which Republican candidate has the best chance of winning the general election?
Of the declared ones right now, Donald Trump.
The crowd laughed, and like it was this preposterous thing. And I'm curious, I mean, you're not new to examining these kinds of movements. You're not new to seeing this sort of thing happen. You've studied across different cultures, different rises to political power, religious splits, and things of that nature. When you first saw him announce his run, did you laugh at it? Or did you foresee that this is going to be something that, oh, he's going to gain traction very quickly?
There was a dimension of... oh, this is silly. He's running to build his brand. He's running to get more attention because what he really wants is attention. It's for celebrity.
Sure.
But it didn't take long. I mean, once we got into the actual voting, to see that he was a serious candidate, or at least being taken seriously. And then it's been a wild ride since then. You know, I think the most interesting answer to that question is, like, when you talk to, like, a lot of African-American friends, scholars, stuff, they were saying, oh, he's going to win. Like, they saw something, not everybody, but some of these friends of mine in the field, they saw something about this country more clearly than I did, and that a lot of us did. That he would become the major party candidate for president, and they would have a chance to win, and that he might actually win. To actually be able to see that in advance indicated a level of pessimism about who this country is and who its Christians are that I wasn't quite able to muster before 2016.
It raises the question, because I think there were two splits, right? There was the people who had optimism and thought this isn't possible. And like the people you mentioned that had this kind of pessimistic, and I mean, rightfully so, pessimistic view of where we were as a country and where the church stood within the United States. And I guess I'm curious, for those who look at Trump as a figure and they're perplexed by how he gained so much evangelical support when he stands counter to almost every perceivable concept of who we know Jesus to have been, what was the draw of evangelicals to Trump? And I'm sure this is a question you've answered 1,000 times, but for the 1,001 time, I'm curious what your perspective is on that.
He embodied a reactionary spirit that was attractive to a lot of Christians. And he embodied an authoritarianism that is unfortunately also attractive to a lot of Christians. And so in other words, what we understand Jesus to have been about has little to do with what Christian politics has been about, if it is understood to be about negative reaction to unhappy cultural trends from their perspective and authoritarianism. In other words, the right question is probably not, what did he have to do with Jesus? And the answer is, he was the antithesis of Jesus, still is. But more like, what was attractive about him to a certain subset of self-identified Christian people who themselves have drifted a long way from the example and teachings of Jesus? And that's a harsh judgment, but I think it's a fair one. And so when Christianity, or when Christians get that distant from the Jesus that they claim to be about, raises questions about what Christianity actually is.
Reactionary politics is exactly where I was hoping you'd go with that answer, because it's something that, you know, reading Kristen DeMay's book and, you know, reading your book, you see this, you know, laid out in times like the 1960s you referenced in your book. Mm-hmm. And you read descriptions of that time period and the evangelical responses to the changes happening during that time. But you could lift all of the things that were happening and use that to describe where we're at now. Like, as much as it is history, it's a reflection of where we're at currently politically as well. And I guess I'm curious, like, keeping this centered around who the public and who evangelicals perceive Jesus to be, do you think part of the reactionary politics reflects the understanding people have of Jesus as being a rebel against the political system of his day and a rebel against the religious system of his day? Because I think many people view Jesus as that rebel archetype, but what he is rebelling against seems to differ in different conversations.
I think it would be generous to say that somebody's thoughtful picture of Jesus has anything to do with right-wing politics in America. I mean, people will attempt such a move. Jesus, rebel against the machine. We're rebels against the machine. Ergo, we're following Jesus. Nice move. I think there's not a lot of plausibility there. It's the 60s. And I would say, well, what I try to say in the book is you see the reactionary paradigm for Christians going back a long time before that. But probably everybody listening to this knows of some people who, maybe their parents, who react to every social change that they have experienced in their lifetime as negative.
Mm-hmm.
And they read American culture, and this is actually true in other cultures too, as having lost its way.
Mm-hmm.
Liberalization, secularization, feminization, the gay rights movement, civil rights movement. I mean, there are some rude words that have long been used to describe all the social changes that people don't like. And imagine a version of religion that ends up saying, every progressive social change that we can name, or the social change that the progressives like, we hate. And every one of these social changes can be interpreted as unwelcome, or even as immoral, or as a rebellion against God and God's law, and maybe also democracy as practiced in the U.S. helps to deliver these social changes that we don't like. And so maybe we have a problem with the entire system, not just the culture, liberal culture, which we're going to blame mainly on Hollywood and New York and the universities and the administrative state and the Democrats. But then the democracy itself, through vote after vote, the conservative side lost, leading one to wonder, maybe leading some of them to wonder whether democracy itself might be part of the problem. And that is, I think, where the hard line reactionary right has turned in the last few years. And Trump has had a lot to do with that.
Well, and you see January 6th, which you mentioned repeatedly in the book, being a reflection of that. Like, when we do not approve of where the democratic process takes us, we're going to react by disrupting any sense of order whatsoever. And, you know, you mentioned this in the book that this conversation may not even be about Trump anymore. And you quoted conservative Matthew Continetti. He said, many on the right embraced a cult of personality and liberal tropes. And the danger was that the alienation from and antagonism toward American culture and society could turn into a general opposition to constitutional order. And I read that, and it's a chilling thing, and it definitely doesn't give you an optimistic outlook of the next couple years. My question, really, coming from a fundamentalist background, where the more that you push up against them, they go, okay, the more persecution we're facing, the more confirmation it is that we're right. This is backlash that is proving our position is to the true one. It's one that culture's scared of. How do you go about actually engaging in meaningful conversation to curtail potentially really devastating effects of this authoritarian perspective of politics?
I think it helps to try to disaggregate some of what people are reacting negatively to, and maybe take it issue by issue. And there used to be a thing where you would test ideas against scripture or against Christian values and see how they held up. Like, for example, the xenophobia around immigration, and the fact that our culture has become more multicultural and multiracial and less white dominant. There's no reason biblically, quote unquote, why that should be a problem. So if people are reacting negatively on the basis of a kind of a whiteness based reaction to a more a racially pluralistic country, that ought to be able to be something we can talk about. Yeah. And also, if the reaction is still backlash to the civil rights movement and to racial integration and to progress towards a more inclusive democracy where people of different races, including the historically oppressed African American people, have an equal place at the table, then I'd be happy to have that conversation anytime with a fundamentalist or an evangelical on the basis of scripture. Tell me what's wrong with that development.
I mean, obviously there are so many racial undertones. There's gender hierarchies that are trying to be preserved in many of these cases. But you also mentioned that just change in general scares people. And that's not a uniquely Christian thing. Like, that's something, if you listen to any average voting bloc, like, the idea of change and like things aren't the way they used to be is a very common sentiment. Do you think that the reaction is fueled primarily by things like racism and misogyny? Or do you think that's just like a side effect of fearing change in general? Because, like, I always go, how much of this is completely sinister and is as racist and misogynistic as it seems versus that just being a side effect of fearing change and fighting against anything that may be progressive?
I do think that change, lots of change, is destabilizing for people. Mm-hmm. And that some changes can be objectively understood to be not welcome, and you could wish that things were better, right? No. I wish that, you know, we were not such a drug addicted culture. I don't think that's a good development. I wish we were better, you know. I wish that our relationships were more sturdy and stable, and family life was doing better. There's a lot of things that I wish. And you know, I kind of wish that we lived in a time when our government functioned better. And when we had fewer guns everywhere, so that you can't go anywhere for a big celebration without being afraid, like in Kansas City, of what would happen there, right? So, and the cumulative impact of lots of change can lead to a nostalgia for an earlier day or a better day or just an unhappiness with the direction of the country. But I think the population that you and I are both most interested in, it's more than just a overall reaction to change. It's a negative reaction to a certain type of change. And that is, on the whole, changes that provided greater freedom and empowerment and recognition and rights for historically suppressed populations. And so if you go all the way back to like the prayer in schools decision that got the Christian right kind of going in 62, they said, oh, they've kicked God out of the schools. But that decision could be interpreted, should be interpreted as an effort to protect the rights of religious minorities. Right? People who didn't fit with the predominant religion of a particular community, didn't want to have Christian prayer shoved down their children's throats in school. Right.
Yeah.
The feminist movement was about empowerment for women, women not being harassed and mistreated and kept from employment opportunities and treated as second class. And, you know, the civil rights movement and so on, you go through the list. It's about recognition and dignity and equality. Most of the things that people are reacting negatively to that they're attributing to godless forces are actually movements for justice and inclusion. And if you're reacting cumulatively to all those changes as somehow a threat to Christianity, then that's a specific kind of problem, I think, that needs to be addressed as such, you know?
I'm going to get you back into today's episode in just a moment. But first, I want to thank the sponsor that is making today's episode possible. And that sponsor is Factor. Factor creates no prep, no mess meals. You can meet your wellness goals in time for summer thanks to the menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, no matter how many podcasts you're recording, going up and down the stairs, trying to take meetings, whatever you're doing, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. And I can say this from experience. They were kind enough to send me a couple of meals for this week, and I enjoyed one just shortly before reading this ad, and it is amazing. And with 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. You can make your day delicious from breakfast to dessert and stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. And these aren't meals that skimp on quality either. You've got things like filet mignon, shrimp, blackened salmon, and so much more. So if you want to try it, go head over to factormeals.com/preacherboys50 and use code preacherboys50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code preacherboys50 at factormeals.com/preacherboys50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Go check out Factor, and now check out the rest of this episode.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% Lean Ground Sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, that was something really interesting. I interviewed Scott Coleman recently, and we were having a conversation about this. And, you know, he just mentioned in voting, like, are you voting for your interests solely, or are you voting for a better, I mean, essentially a better country for everybody, like a truly just and fair country? And like that thought process seems very simple, like very elementary, but it is not something that many consider. Like, you stand in the voting booth going, what makes this a better experience for me? And I think that kind of raises like the biggest weakness of democracy that you lay out in your book, is that bad people can use that system. You know, you mentioned Hitler, right, was elected democratically, who's obviously like the easiest example to point to. But you look at, you know, you look at someone like, you look at someone like Trump, you look at people who rise up and create a really good world for some people while excluding many others. And I interviewed a long time ago, I interviewed Brian Kloss, who wrote a book called Corruptible. And he talks about in that, you know, bad people are disproportionately good at getting power, disproportionately good at keeping it, and they desire it the most out of everybody. And so when you have bad people who are the best at getting power, how do you protect the democratic process from constantly bringing in the worst of the worst? Like, they're not sending their best people, to quote Trump.
To quote somebody, they're not sending their best people. That's a great line. Yes, it is. It is a constitutional flaw, you might say, of democracy, that sometimes people with a hunger for power and without a democratic bone in their body seize power through the democratic process. Hitler is a good example, though, and he was very clear from the 20s forward that he did not believe in democracy. He believed in autocracy, but he would use, after the coup failed in 23, he decided he would use the democratic process until he could consolidate his dictatorship, which he did. Viktor Orban in Hungary, who I talk about in the book, he was elected democratically twice as president, or prime minister, I guess, and then managed to snip away at constitutional constraints so that he is now really president for life, it sure looks like. Right. Trump signaled disrespect for democratic norms from the beginning of his candidacy. Now, one thing that the political philosophers Ziblatt and Levitsky in their book, How Democracies Die, they say that democracies and political parties need to have kind of an alert system, like, so that you might say you can have an immune reaction if somebody comes along who is not really wanting to play by the rules of the game. Right. And so you, like, it ought to be a non-negotiable for any political party in a democracy that if somebody arises who sends all kinds of anti-democratic signals, then the party itself excludes them. So you say you want to run as a Republican. Well, maybe we like some of your policy positions, but you're not functioning. Your rhetoric says you're opposed to democracy itself. That disqualifies you. So they said, Ziblatt and Levitsky said, the Republican Party should have disqualified Trump in 2015, 2016. That was where the immune system should have reacted. And 16 other candidates who were more democratic than Trump, that is, more interested in democracy, could have been selected. But the party failed, and there's a reason why parties are not what they used to be. And now Trump owns the Republican Party, so they're not going to put up any resistance to him. But if parties are weak and you're in a celebrity-oriented culture, and you have a weak understanding of the norms of democracy, then it does leave a country more susceptible to having an autocrat work their way to power through the democratic process. And that's, I think, what we have had happen here.
You mentioned just now, like you give examples in your book, and you spend a large portion of your book talking about American politics, spending time in other countries. And it's fascinating reading about other countries' political systems. And I realized reading your book how little we know about other countries' political systems and the way that they operate. And I guess I'm curious from this perspective, it seems like so many issues that we see within the church, within politics, within just day-to-day life is rooted in a lack of education and a lack of understanding of history, a lack of understanding of, you know, cultural patterns. And, you know, I like to think that I'm more well-read than the average person. I like to think that I keep up with some of these things. But reading through your book, I'm reading things and going, I never knew that. I never knew that. And I'm curious for you, how do you think people should go about educating themselves to make more informed decisions and to be able to see some of these red flags? Because like we said earlier, there's people who saw Trump who didn't pick up on some of the issues that are now present. Like you have the voter's regret later on down the road where they go, oh, I just thought he was going to drain the swamp and he was going to do all these things that resonated with me as someone who just saw that something wasn't working. Mm-hmm. But then I saw, oh, this is who he really was. What are the first steps in becoming at least loosely educated in how democracy should function and how we should engage politically? And I know that could probably be a whole nother book.
I'm trying to look at the list of warning signs that, where is that? Maybe it's page 35. First of all, while I'm looking for this,
it's amazing that you got page 35 right, because that's exactly where it is.
I'll start off by saying I want to totally and sadly affirm what you said about how little we understand about not just other countries' political systems, but about our own. It feels to me, after I'm working on this book, I actually had to do plenty of homework myself to, like, that chapter on what is democracy and, you know, how do you define it and how is it different from authoritarianism? I certainly didn't get that in 12th grade government class taught by the gym teacher. You know, I didn't get that.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
And I didn't have to take government in college. How is that even possible? I picked it up some in ethics. In other words, I'm a pretty well-educated person myself, and I had to do my homework to even be able to recover and define what it is that democracy is.
Did you sit down to write the book thinking, I've got a pretty good understanding of democracy, that'll be the easy part to write about? And then you start writing pen to paper and go, oh, there's a lot of blank spots here.
Yeah, I did have that experience. But I also think we've been able to take democracy for granted here. Like there's a lot of things we take for granted if they are just in the air we breathe, right? You know, how does capitalism work? Well, I mean, it's harder to describe than it is to participate in because we're doing it every day, right? So in general, we have a woeful, lack of understanding of government and how democracy is and how it functions, the branches of government, even just the basic civic stuff, and even worse, what's happening in other countries. But one of the things, I mean, let's say you don't have to become an expert in political theory to be able to pay attention to warning signs. And this is what Levitsky and Zablatt say. They summarize authoritarian political behavior into four key categories: rejection of democratic rules of the game, like, for example, acknowledging the results of an election. That's a democratic rule of the game. Mm-hmm. Denial of the legitimacy of political opponents, like, not, this is somebody who, you know, could just as easily win and we disagree, but they're honorable. Right, you don't do that anymore. Toleration or encouragement of political violence, and readiness to curtail the civil liberties of opponents, including the media. Okay, if every American had those four tests imprinted on their like forearms, I recommend mass tattooing. Okay. then okay, here comes a candidate. Denial of the legitimacy of political opponents, check. Toleration of or encouragement of political violence, check. Etc. Right. In other words, they say Trump was sending these signals as running while he was running for president in 2015. And that was different, and that there were norms before that. That were trampled. And so we at least need to know where the guardrails are that separates a democracy from an authoritarian state and try to protect the democracy that we have. At least that.
In my interview with Scott, I was saying like there's, because he talked about dog whistles a lot in the book, which I was like, it's more like bullhorns at this point with a lot of these statements. Yeah. But I am curious because there's people who would say, who are listening to this, we live in a unprecedented technological era where maybe we do have concerns about voting, and maybe we do have concerns about how we can shore up elections and make ourselves less vulnerable to hacks and things like that, which I think is a good conversation to have. Like, security is important. You have people who would have a conversation and say, you know, hey, there's some legitimate concerns about these people who are running. You know, or like this person who's unqualified from the left and the right. But I guess my question is, how do you engage in fruitful dialogue about concerns about something in the political system without inadvertently dog whistling authoritarian leaning people who would say, see, that's why Trump actually won the election. Hey, that's why so-and-so should be ineligible to run, even though objectively they're completely fine to run. So how do you go about examining these things without, again, inadvertently jumping into this conspiratorially minded group of people?
Well, I think it helps. And one thing I try to do in the book is to describe best practices in democracy. Mm-hmm. Like I quote the Freedom House standards related to, you know, what is a democracy? And it has like best practices criteria of, yeah, there it is, political rights and civil liberties. So, for example, this is on page 17. Was the current head of government or other chief national authority elected through free and fair elections? Okay. So everybody who cares about democracy should care about election administration.
Right.
You want the election to be free and fair. And there's a lot that goes into that. Things like that candidates are not suppressed in getting their message out, you know, that that media covers candidates fairly, that there be opportunities for debate, and that there is the election administration process that is scrupulously fair, nonpartisan, and accountable. So, and you're right that with... with technological developments, to the extent that we have technologized our voting process and we're not just using paper and pencil and putting it in a box, right? Then one must pay close attention to making elections hack-proof. One thing they did in Georgia, as I recall, was to require a paper copy of all votes. So the machines were recording the votes, but they were spitting out paper votes, voting records, so that the machine could always be checked against paper. So yeah, there are things that can be done. You know, and there are some things I would like, I mean, you know, I'd like to be sure that we're not fiddling with the rules all the time so that they're not clear, or, you know, how late can you turn in an absentee ballot? And, you know, or what about people being able to collect ballots and deliver them from point A to point B? Yeah, these are all things worth considering at the state level. But wild-eyed conspiracy theories involving absolutely implausible claims, and then all of them shot down by the courts in 2020, then you're in a different zone. Then you're in the zone of la-la land, right? But I do think it's to link back to our opening topic. conspiracy theories emerge both because of disinformation and propaganda and because of people's willingness and readiness to believe disinformation and propaganda. And on the Christian right, they've talked themselves into this idea. There is no way that our country that we love could possibly ever elect a Democrat or Joe Biden or could possibly have voted against our man Trump. Because every right-thinking person that I know is voting our way.
Mm-hmm.
The deep state, you know, and so on, right? Those Democrats are running the elections in Detroit or Atlanta or something. And so therefore there must be a conspiracy. But that every time we do this, every time we go into litigation over basic election counting, we tear at the threads of our tattered democracy.
Yeah. Well, you kind of pointed at something there. Everybody that I know, and I think there's something really interesting about just Christian culture, because you are within a church of the phrase that we heard all the time growing up of like-minded believers, you're in a very tight echo chamber that one probably doesn't experience in a secular workplace as much, or in a random social gathering that's not tied to a religious belief. And so the thing that I see, which is why I wasn't overly surprised with the Trump support, is that people will literally take some of the things you mentioned, the conspiracy elements, the discrediting of elections, the, you know, fill in the blank. And that is like the litmus test to see if they will support somebody. Do you agree with our collective belief around vaccines, voters, you know, like all these different things? And so I guess, again, I just keep circling back to, and maybe there's not a good answer to this, is how do you go about getting into those conversations with those people to have them remove these bizarre, like, again, litmus checks for, do I want to vote for, whoever, fill in the blank with whoever that is. Like, how do you go about doing that without making them revert deeper into their shell and go like, oh, you're the outside telling us what to believe?
Yeah. I think it is getting harder and harder to penetrate these enclaves. Though I would say there are enclaves on the left and on the right. We're just in general.
Oh, 100%.
You know, we're sorting. And we're sorting on the basis of politics. Geographical sorting is real. Friendship sorting is real. Even family sorting is real. Where people, you know, they would not date or marry or want as a son and daughter-in-law somebody who is of the different political party. I mean, think about that. I mean, think about how intense that has become, you know. I didn't check it out. Maybe this is propaganda itself, but I read that 20% of Americans believe the possibility, at least, that the whole Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce thing is an electioneering plot for Biden, right? You know? 20%, right? So I don't know how you penetrate that level of conspiracy thinking, right? The logical thing would be, to the extent that something is being talked about in Christian churches and Sunday school classes and Christian online spaces, that other Christians, maybe respected voices in proximate Christian communities, might be able to speak into that, you know? So, but what I think has happened is that even the evangelical establishment, National Association of Evangelicals, or seminary presidents, or seminary professors like I am, have less and less influence over the thought of grassroots people who identify as evangelicals and fundamentalists. Mm-hmm. It's like we've lost, I'm not evangelical anymore, but to say they've lost leadership in many ways of their communities. And so I remember seeing the statistic that, you know, who do you trust? And the answer is they trusted Donald Trump more than their pastor, you know? Yeah. So the information ecosystem is so poor, and the ability to access it and penetrate it with some other information is so weak. It seems it's just a matter of of winning or losing, either a point of view is going to be discredited time after time by being defeated, or it's not, you know. But if all you've got is win-lose, then you don't have conversation anymore, and it's kind of scary, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the definition of the culture war, you know. It's like, we're going to go to battle with you with our side in mind. And the idea of bipartisanship to me sounds like a theory, you know. Like, I'm 28 years old, and I hear people talk about like these very like normal political processes, and I hear people talk about bipartisanship, and I like try to think of examples of true bipartisanship that I've seen in my lifetime that I haven't read about in a history book.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find it, you know, and it's hard to think of a true separation between church and state. Like, it's hard for me to believe in that beyond just being this idyllic concept that you could point to. And so it's a scary thing to be entered into, and it feels just very tribal, you know, from a, you know, religious perspective, because even religiously there's conservative versus liberal, you know. Yeah. I look at people like yourself, I look at people like a Kristen Dume, who, you know, endorsed your book, and I loved her book. And I would find myself largely now religiously unaffiliated, unsure of what I would believe in a spiritual realm. But I see people who do identify as Christian, wouldn't identify as evangelical, who to me reflect a version of Christianity that seems to align with a Jesus that I would know and understand. Mm-hmm. But then I look at the general evangelical consensus, and those people are hated. You know, like I told you before we hit record, like, I became aware of you through James White early on, and the vehement just rage toward people like you, toward people like a Kristen Dume, a Beth Alsenbar, fill in the blank. It's startling to me, and it makes me go like, guys, what are you doing even in this orbit? Because like, this is just not, like, you're not welcome in this space. Why do you think the Christians who seem to be sane are most villainized within evangelical circles? Because it feels by a wide margin, like, there's just this outrage on when you go to Twitter, when you go to Facebook, when you go to other books, resources, podcasts. It just seems like those who are the peacemaker mentality seem to really be despised by the Christian majority.
The villainization is real, that's for sure. I experienced it most intensely after I wrote Changing Our Mind in 2014, yeah, which was about LGBT inclusion. It was actually a pretty cautious book, but it ended up in an inclusive posture. And I think that was when dear brother James White decided he wanted to debate me, like, yeah, forever. We were going to debate. And then that was when I first experienced what Twitter could be like, when trolls decided to come at you. And I'm now finally off of Twitter and its successor, because I concluded that it was more toxic than of any value to me. So I actually quit. Yeah. It. But, well, we're the enemies within the gate, right? Because we say in the name of Christ, in the name of Christian values, that we think that other expression of Christian values is wrongheaded, and here's why. It's harder to dismiss us, though the effort is certainly made. It's harder to dismiss us as just godless secular liberals, but because we share the faith, or at least it's hard to just blanket deny that we are fellow Christians, though, again, the effort is made. So the worst enemies are always the ones who are viewed as traitors within the gate, as opposed to just outsiders. You know,
the episode I'm releasing this Sunday, I talked with a guest about that, where we were taught like-mindedness equals safety, and that having dialogue with someone who disagrees with you is unsafe. It's a slippery slope that'll lead you to, you know, I mean, eternal consequences.
Yeah,
if you really
right.
screw this up.
Yeah.
No pressure when you're having these conversations.
You know, the guilt by association, I've had invitations canceled left and right after 2014, because it's like, well, we invited him to come speak about, say, I don't know, economics or war or something, but he's a heretic on this other issue, so therefore he's ruled out on all issues. And and then it could go so far as, well, this person endorsed their book, so they're also ruled out, and you know, in a ramifying chain of people you can't talk to because they're guilty by association. You know, that is the fundamentalist mindset, and it never changes. That part of it never changes.
I don't know if you're the right person to even ask this question to, but it's just something that's on my mind. So we can talk about it, or we can skip it if it's not. One of the things that's really interesting to me is growing up extremely fundamentalist, and then apologetics was such a heavy thing, like always being ready to give an answer for your faith, always, and your faith meant always ready to give an answer on your political stance, your views on gender, like everything under the sun. You had to have some pocket answer to go into. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's hard for me to not look at Christianity as a very rigid black and white system in many ways. And objective truth is something that gets said all the time. Like, we have objective things we need to protect, objective truth about this. How much of a responsibility do you think the church has to define borders between what is truth versus what is not? Because like, I'm of the mindset now, there's no danger in hearing someone's other perspective and having those open forum conversations. But I know there's probably some, maybe even pastors listening, who would go, I don't want to welcome in a perspective that could lead people astray from objective truth. Like, is there a responsibility to draw those boundaries, to warn people of false teaching, so to speak? Like, how do you go about doing that in a way that's not culty and controlling and terminating thought?
Now, I'll wear the hat of being a pastor, having been a pastor. I think the goal of a pastor in a community, or of a teacher in a community, is to move people towards central convictions on which they can be confident that they can build their lives on these convictions, and it's also practices. It's a way of life. By the way, that was underemphasized in fundamentalism sometimes. It was all about, if you had the right pocket answer and you could defend your faith, then that was Christianity.
Right.
But Christianity, I think, is better understood as not just a set of beliefs, but a way of life. And maybe also a set of character qualities like, love and justice. And if I were hosting or wanting my people to think through an issue, and thought that a point counterpoint would be helpful, it would be within a range. Take the issue of war. There's really three main positions on the ethics of war that I would want people to consider: pacifism, just war theory, and just peacemaking. I would not invite somebody who was arguing for genocide. That's beyond the pale. So some perspectives are beyond the pale of what should even be put on the table. I would not invite, in a conversation about the Holocaust, I would not invite a Holocaust denier or a neo-Nazi. There'd be ranges of opinion about different things where reputable people could be invited, but that would be beyond the pale. So the problem with fundamentalism was the line drawing was constant, and the box of opinions you could even consider was way too small.
Sure.
Yeah. So, this is it. This is the zone right here, right? That's all you got.
Yeah. I always describe it as like the moving goalpost. It's like, we're always going to change it to be where we need the conversation to be. I guess this goes to like the next level of this is, you mentioned things that are beyond the pale, which I would agree on the things you said. But I guess the question that, I play devil's advocate all day in my mind, so I go back and forth with these things myself, is like, who defines what is beyond the pale? Because there's some who would listen, who again would say, well, have you actually engaged with what so-and-so said about the Holocaust? You know, like, because there's people that, I see that on Twitter all day, especially now, as Twitter's gotten, it's gotten way worse since you left, just so you know. It's not gotten better. But they'll say, like, well, look at this. Like, the information's not harmful. Like, you need to look at this. And I would disagree with those people, just for the record. I would not put myself in the camp of Holocaust denying, which is sad. I have to expressly say that. But who defines what's beyond the pale in these conversations? Because I think that was one of big Trump's big weapons, right? Is like the fake news media wants you to believe this, yeah. or so-and-so wants you to believe this. Your line should be here. If everybody's drawing their own line, how do we come to agreement on even the stage of debate?
I think that's a great question. There's no real better answer than to say that the community itself, as shaped by its norms, traditions, scriptures, sacred texts, and ethos, is all the time in a process of setting and then sometimes renegotiating what those boundary lines are, right? And this raises this question about our country. In what meaningful sense can it be said that we are a community?
Wow.
A community, by definition, there's unity, there's commonality, and there's unity, thus community. We don't have unity and we don't have commonality. We just all happen to be American citizens or to live within the borders of the United States of America politically. But this is something that has exercised political philosophers for all time. Can you have any well-functioning political order if you don't have a shared account of reality or a shared account of morality or of common values or vision or whatever? Did you notice the other day when President Biden said about Trump, what he said about NATO and Russia going ahead and taking those NATO countries is un-American? That language?
Yeah.
That language is a way of saying we are a community. This community has certain standards and norms. That statement violated it.
Wow.
Right? Un-American, well, that's such an interesting adjective, right? I mean, who defines what is American and what is un-American, and is that a good word or a bad word? But that's Biden attempting to say there are boundaries. Yeah. That violates a boundary. And so every community, you might say, I like the language of margins and center, right? Mm-hmm. Every community has a circumference, but also a center. Every community that can function. And so, like, if you're leading a family or a group of friends are making a decision or a business or a church, you're only going to be able to move forward together if there's some sense of common vision and common values. Here's who we are. Here's what we're trying to do. I fear that there's very little of that left in the U.S. And so anytime I see any evidence that we kind of have any shared vision happening about anything, even if it's we all like watching the Super Bowl, that's something. I mean, give me something.
Sure.
You know, we like our sports, or we like our entertainment figures. So sometimes this is discussed as, is there any common cultural ground at all?
Yeah.
This, by the way, is what's kind of problematic about the whole Taylor Swift thing. She was kind of common ground. Like, everybody loved Taylor
Swift. If we can't agree on Taylor Swift, we're done as a country.
I mean, think about it. You can't agree that she's, you know, an interesting figure who's made some interesting and good music, right? She's a good entertainer. Now we're fighting about Taylor Swift, right? So I struggle between two competing impulses for me personally. One is I'm trying to defend a certain kind of position that is over against that of people who I think are making a fundamental mistake. And that's kind of what this book is about, you know, this democracy book. On the other hand, I'm also pleading with myself and my group and other groups and everybody to try not to tear this country apart at the seams, to try to find some places of common ground so we can live together in community. And so the quest for unity on the one side, and the quest, you might say, for my side's opinion to prevail, these feel at tension in my own spirit.
Well, I know I only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, in your book, you mentioned that counter-revolution's never over. There's always another enemy to defeat. And I guess I opened with a quote from you in 2016. If you're to look forward into the future, put on your prophet hat one more time. What do you foresee the next, counter-revolution to be? What do you think is going to be the next target in the sights of the right-wing kind of evangelical, or even more broadly, the Christo-authoritarian movement that you define within your book?
I'm quite confident that they would like to reverse pretty much everything that has happened on the LGBTQ recognition and rights front since the 1970s. And certainly the overturning of gay marriage, maybe sending that back to the states as well, would be a goal.
Yeah. Well, that's been audibly stated as a goal after the overturning of Roe versus Wade. That was literally, that's next. That's on the docket.
I mean, again, if you think about the counter-revolutionaries or the reactionaries, or they're not happy with pretty much anything that has happened since 1962.
Sure.
So picture something that has happened since 62 and then think of it being reversed, right? So the constitutional church-state structure has already been chipped away at quite a bit by the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, whether it's gay marriage or, the Kristen DeMay's book is partly about how many ferocious patriarchs are still out there and would like to reverse the gains of the feminist movement, there's definitely a profound effort to reverse the victories that were won at such cost by the civil rights movement. So the answer is, picture anything that people don't like that happened since 1962. There are some people attempting to reverse it. I don't know how much progress they're going to make because they're not a majority, but they're a determined minority and they're pretty organized. That's my stern, unhappy prophecy. What's going to happen in the politics? I'm not sure. I think it's neck and neck. Whether we will elect a candidate who will snip away at democracy the way that Orban has done in Hungary is a live possibility as we speak today. Yeah. I hope it doesn't go that way. I don't know what the outcome will be.
Right. My original final question was, where do we go from here? And are you optimistic or not? But I think you just answered that question. So
we defeat anti-democratic candidates and try to return to something like normal democratic politics. So we must defeat Donald Trump. Somebody like Nikki Haley, for example, it's a totally different order of magnitude of what we're talking about. There you have policy differences, as opposed to the survival of democracy as a political system. So that is the number one order of the day. We can talk about other things after November.
Well, I would absolutely love to do that. But thank you so much for taking the time to do this and for your book. It's always interesting going into these conversations because I've gotten to read so much of your thoughts, but to actually get to ask you some direct questions has been amazing. If anyone's listening, be sure to grab a copy of Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. It's a really fascinating read and a great educational tool. Thank you so much, David, for joining me on this episode.
Thank you, Eric. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.